Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
A lot to the dogs of science, including our understanding of Pavlovian conditioning and of that reliable dose of oxytocin we get when we engage in a little affectionate eye contact. What we owe them in return may be impossible to calculate, but at the very least, we owe them humane treatment, and we owe it to them to actually get the science right. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In the past, scientists studying dogs' psychology and cognition often kept them living in labs, whereas now a lot of behavioral research dogs live with families and make day trips to participate in testing. Animal cruelty laws have helped protect dogs from needlessly traumatic experimentation. But old, incorrect conclusions of science have sometimes been slow to change, so that some dog trainers still believe humans must establish dominance with their animals to get them to act right. As it turns out, the history of our study of dogs is a fascinating way to understand the evolution of science itself. Jules Howard is a wildlife expert, zoology correspondent, science writer, and broadcaster. His book is called Wonder Dog: The Science of Dogs and Their Unique Friendship with Humans. Jules, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure.
It's a pretty neat trick, I think, to explore a bit of human history through the lens of our dogs. There's evidence, of course, that we humans have loved canines for millennia. Why were there whole decades during the 20th century when, like, serious zoologists assumed studying dogs was not worth the trouble?
That's a really good question, actually, and I can speak from personal experience about what kind of happened there. In the kind of 80s and 90s, dogs had quite a rich history for good and bad in helping us understand more about animal minds. And then there was this, as you say, this kind of wilderness years. And that was partly because, you know, we were understanding more about chimpanzees and gorillas and even dolphins and other social animals that you could study in the wild. And to a degree, I mean, I wanted, you know, at university to study dogs, and I was kind of laughed out the room. And the idea was that, you know, why would you want to study something that's been corrupted by being associated with humans for so long? You know, it's really difficult to work out, you know, which of the bits they genuinely feel for us and which of the bits it's about conditioning and about rewards and about all the treats they get in the kitchen. So they kind of were viewed as the outsiders, I suppose. And it was a, you know, genuine wilderness years. And it's only in the last 15 years, particularly in the last 10 years, that, wow, you know, a lot of these wildlife scientists are kind of thinking, goodness, you know, dogs are exhibiting things that we thought only chimpanzees and gorillas could do.
Darwin sometimes mentioned dogs in his work, maybe as a way of connecting with human readers. Was he aware of their evolution by something other than natural selection? Was that clear to Darwin?
I think, well, one of the things was, at that point, no one was quite sure exactly where dogs had come from. You know, there was this idea that, you know, they were descended from wolves, of course, but also this idea that they were a kind of complex muddle of, you know, coyotes, wolves, even foxes. And so at the time, there was this, you know, that kind of, I suspect Darwin thought, you know, that we may never know that. I mean, Darwin didn't have an understanding, obviously, that we could use, you know, genetics to find out really clearly where the roots of dogs lie. But I think his assertion that, you know, they were from the canids, you know, the group that includes coyotes and foxes, etc., would have been spot on. But also, I mean, the thing that I always try and come across, I'm not like a super Darwin fan, okay? I sound like a real fanboy here, but one of the things that I do really, really like about his research at the time was that he had this, you know, good evidence, swathes of evidence from all sorts of different fields suggesting that, you know, natural selection was a real driving force in evolution. But particularly this idea that, you know, human emotions are not, you know, completely separated from nature. You know, this idea that a lot of the things that we feel are mammal emotions, and as such, we should expect to see them in, you know, in other mammals, including dogs. And, you know, at the time that was quite daring. And it's only, I would say, in the last 25 years that we're kind of like, wow, do you know what? That was absolutely right. You know, the evidence is so strong that many of the things that dogs feel really are, you know, genuine, scientifically provable emotions that do correlate, I suppose, with ours, which is kind of weird because we all know that, right?
Anyone who's been around a dog, for sure.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you had a scientist like Conway Lloyd Morgan. What kind of work did he do with dogs in the late 19th century? First of all, just to understand how dogs could learn things.
Yeah, I mean, he was a kind of super skeptic, but a follower of Darwin, but, you know, really, really wanted to make sure that what we think of, you know, what people were thinking about dogs back then really was the truth. So one of his legacies is actually like kind of learning curves. So he had his pet dog. So in Darwin's age, a lot of it was about like, you've got a pet dog, let's use it for science. So his pet dog, he kept it in his backyard, and there was a little latched fence, a little gate. And he observed that, you know, his dog, wow, was able to work the latch on this gate and escape. And everyone was kind of like, this is incredible. You know, this dog's able to, you know, look at a latch and think about it and work out how it works and, you know, and use it to the dog's advantage. And in fact, by looking, repeating that experiment with the same dog, realized that essentially it was about like kind of scrabbling around. So the first trial, the dog had scrabbled around the gate, barking at passers-by and, you know, hit upon this solution. The second time, similar, but it took, say, 15 minutes. Third time, 10 minutes. Fourth time, 3 minutes. And then, you know, you see on a graph, plotted on a graph, that you know, essentially what a learning curve is. So I guess that was kind of important in challenging. There was a lot of kind of psychism. So a lot of kind of like dogs, you know, they're supernatural. They have this crazy inability to do things. And actually, Conway Morgan's kind of an important character in this, because he's kind of said, look, it may well be natural. It doesn't need to be boxed in this supernatural category. Our job as scientists is to, you know, study that box, I guess you could say. So, yeah, he's an interesting character. And people don't normally mention him to me, but, you know, I think he's important. One of the important characters in the book, definitely.
What is Morgan's canon, and how does it still influence the way animal behavioral science works today?
So it's essentially the idea that the most simplest explanation to explain a curious animal behavior is most likely to be the correct one. And it's always been something, you know, I remember hearing about in, you know, lectures and academia, and it comes up quite a lot. And I think one of the things all of us as animal lovers do is we want to see the thing that confirms our pre-existing belief. And mostly that's, you know, that's fair enough. But in some cases it can be more difficult, I suppose. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I wonder if you remember this, there was a photo of a kangaroo that was seemingly holding its kind of lover in its arms. And, you know, it looked grief-stricken. And that got lots of media attention. And it was really tragic to actually see that photo. But of course, you know, on closer investigation by, you know, kangaroo biologists, essentially in that case, the male was attempting to have his way, let's say, with the female, even though she was obviously in no state to do so. So I think Morgan's canon kind of helps us analyze animal behaviors with more rigor, I guess you could say.
Even after canon came along, not everybody had quite so much rigor. How did John Lubbock feed this perception that dogs could be taught to read, or at least to comprehend human language in a way much different than what they might do?
Yeah, I mean, this is so Lubbock is quite a character in British. He was quite a character, I should say, in British politics from about the same time as Darwin, who's the first person to award us bank holidays over here in Britain. So, but yeah, his again using his own dog, a lovely poodle, he devised this amazing test, and he made three signs and wrote words on them. And one of the signs said bone, one of the signs said water, and one of the signs said out, as in let me out. And he placed them on the floor and let his poodle investigate them. And whenever the poodle picked up one of the signs, Lubbock, you know, did whatever was on the sign. And Lubbock absolutely adored the fact that, you know, literally within, you know, a day or two, his poodle named Van was like wielding the sign that said bone. Like you can imagine it every day, like bone time, let's go, let's go. But by introducing new signs, he was in his eyes teaching, teaching this poodle to read, you know, and the poodle was in his view speaking. And I think what I find really interesting about that, and many of your listeners will know there's a few dogs on Instagram who are really, really famous, you know, like hundreds of thousands of followers, and they use speech boards. So they basically, I don't know if you've seen, they press buttons on a board and it says, you know, the button will say outside or feed or happy or sad. And, you know, it's fascinating, I suppose, that kind of study is still going on. And the truth is, it's really difficult for us to work out to what degree dogs understand, you know, whether, I suppose there's two extremes. One, the dog is thinking, okay, I press this button, great, I'm expressing myself, even though it doesn't necessarily understand, you know, the difference between the noise happy and the noise sad. And the other extreme is, you know, that the dogs are, as we know, absolutely amazing at conditioning themselves for treats if they're in the mood. And it could be a mixture of both. We don't yet know. So, I mean, I'm one of many scientists, you know, calling for more studies into the soundboards and the idea of dogs pressing buttons. I think it's really fascinating. It could well go somewhere. But also, it's so interesting that, you know, 150 years ago, the same science was being done, albeit in a non-digital way.
Well, you mentioned conditioning, and there's really no way to talk about dogs and science without talking about Ivan Pavlov. First of all, why did he settle on dogs as good lab subjects for the work he was doing?
That's a really good question. That's a really, really good question. Because we think of, you know, laboratory animals, and we think of the familiar repertoire of, you know, mice or fruit flies. But of course, you know, 120 years ago, the most accessible animals were street dogs, sadly. And, you know, it's hard for us to imagine now, but, you know, of course, every Western, and of course in Russia as well, you know, every city and town had its own population of street dogs. It's kind of the natural condition, I guess you could argue, for dogs on planet Earth. So that's one reason. But also, Pavlov's a different, very different character to Darwin. Darwin's kind of like, I'll just sit in a chair and be quite anecdotal. Whereas Pavlov's like, no, I'm going to get some seriously good quality data. Day one, day two, day three, I'm going to make some really impressive graphs and really do long-term studies. And sadly, those long-term studies were performed on dogs because, you know, they're the easiest ones to house. They're the easiest animals to sort of keep alive for long periods. So, I mean, in the book, I mean, I'm being a bit guarded because I don't want to upset listeners. But, you know, this is although the science of conditioning went on to inspire psychology and animal behavior, really big deal in the history of science, the actual day-to-day, the abuse suffered by these dogs, which I actually name in the book, is tragic. It's really, really, really tragic. But I think it's in some ways, you know, worth us remembering that. I don't know about you, but at school, I remember learning about Pavlov, and it was kind of like, oh, here's this nice guy.
Right. And he's with his pet dog,
you know, yeah. With his pet dog, and he's ringing a little bell, and, you know, it's all very quaint. But obviously, the actual truth of the science behind it is, as I say, it's not for the faint-hearted, really.
We've known for some time that dogs are descended from wolves. Certainly, we suspected that relationship long before then. So it would seem to make sense that studying wolf behavior would teach us something about dogs. But it led early on to some really flawed conclusions about, like, dominance and submission and alpha dogs. What did the earliest studies looking at the behavior of wolves fail to notice?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, the culture, you know, culture versus science thing is, I mean, this is one of the best examples I would say there is. Pavlovian ideas are that, you know, conditioning, if a dog has a bad experience, it won't want to do that again. If a dog has a good experience, it gets, you know, treats, it will repeat that behavior. So that, it sounds quite simple now, but for its time, that was really, really groundbreaking. And I suppose it's painful in some ways that Pavlov's ideas were taken on by early dog trainers in Germany. So Germany in World War One was like by far and away the most incredible nation for training dogs for use in war, to lay cables, to find injured soldiers. They were cut above, and the reason was that those dog trainers had taken hold of Pavlov's ideas, if you like, and essentially, if the dog does anything bad, if the dog doesn't do what it's told, it gets punished, physically punished. So everyone was looking at Pavlov. Everyone's looking at the incredible advances that the Germans were making in terms of dog training. And they're like, wow, punishment's really powerful. And so that idea of kind of getting dogs to do what you want through violence was in the European consciousness, I would say. So everyone starts going, okay, 1940s, we need to work out where dogs have come from. We think they've come from wolves. Let's look at wolves and see what, their personalities are like. And in some ways, it goes back to what I said before. We bring preconceptions to arguments, even in science. And this is an example of where that's happened. So a scientist called Rudolf Schenkel was like, I'm going to study wolves and work out, what they're like so we can better understand dogs. And Schenkel's study involved watching wolves interact. He noticed that there's a lot of bloodshed. Wolves, according to him, they love fighting. It was all about, becoming the boss. And in his terms, he introduced in his paper this idea of, the alpha male, the alpha female. And that was one of the papers, that was one of the studies that the dog training community really, really saw and took to. Partly because, again, they've been inspired and nudged, if you like, by the German training school, but also Pavlov as well. So to those people in the 1940s, it all fitted together, So that's all well and good. And essentially, that's how science works. Rudolf Schenkel was a very, accomplished scientist. And, he'd done this study of wolves. That's it. OK, wolves are obviously all about alphas. Therefore, dogs must be too. But the problem, the big problem was that about 20 years later, scientists started looking at Rudolf Schenkel's study, his famous study on wolves, and realized that there were some big problems with his experimental design. The first was that Rudolf's wolves were not wild wolves. They were captive wolves. So in other words, they were kept in a zoo, and there were a bunch of wolves recruited from the wild and basically unrelated to each other, put in a single cage. Now, if you do that with any mammal, pretty much you are going to expect the same thing. You're going to see fighting. I suppose you could call them dominance behaviors, show themselves really clearly. So that's not a wolf thing. That's very much a mammal thing. So that idea, people realized that probably better idea to study wolves in the wild, which they did. And they realized, of course, that in the wild, wolves are seriously territorial and very capable of bloodshed. But mostly they are living in social groups that kind of avoid as much contact with other wolf groups as possible. And those social groups are made up not by an alpha male or an alpha female. They're made up simply as family groups. So in other words, mum and dad and the kids. So 20 years it took scientists to look at Schenkel's studies and go, okay, maybe the alpha thing is not actually a real phenomenon. Maybe it's a classic mammal phenomenon. And it took culture. Well, I'll be honest, in the UK, there's still quite a vast subset of society here that thinks that, we should be doing everything we can to stop our dogs becoming alphas, So over here, it's kind of like, no, you must walk in front of your dog when you go through a door. You must make sure that your dog eats after you. You must make sure your dog doesn't try and jump and, jump on your back if you're doing your shoelaces up or something like that, And these ideas are still here in society. So I suppose one hope I had with the book, having spoken to hundreds of scientists, is that we can pull the science and the culture together just that little bit more, I guess.
The behaviorist B.F. Skinner helped us understand dogs are responsive to both negative and positive rewards. And you bring up the scenario in the book that I think may be familiar to people and also explain a lot. It's a positive reinforcement and yet an annoying dog behavior when they bark every day at the postal carrier, right? Can you explain how that plays out for the dog and why this behavior gets stronger and stronger over time?
Yeah, I can. I mean, as you said, like, we all know it, and the, your listeners, I know they'll be thinking, "Oh gosh, yeah." And essentially, there is a there are a few quirks, if you like, of dog behavior, and you know, behaviors can become set. In other words, the dog does something a few times and goes, "Oh, I kind of got a reward there, so I'll just keep doing it." So the classic one, and I've had this with a few dogs. I don't know if this is something I'm doing wrong, but you know, is the, you know, when someone knocks on the door. And we have an Amazon delivery or whatever at our door. And the dog goes, bark, 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 not very happy at all. And the delivery person, once they've delivered the package through the letterbox, walks away. And the dog goes, brilliant, that worked with treat.
Well done,
so
me.
So I'll do that right. again. Yeah, well done, me. And the same is true. I mean, we used to have a dog, lovely dog called Biff, who was completely, I mean, really, he was a handful, let me say. But he, you know, he would, similar sort of thing with bikes, you know, if a bike went past, you know, naturally the bike comes towards you, you bark, you go crazy, and the bike moves away from you, jobs are good, and you know, jobs good. So there are these behaviors, and it's it can be really challenging to get through those. But you know, conditioning, I was saying about Pavlov, and yes, the science was terrible, and in many ways Pavlov was corrupt. He was, you know, engaged in nefarious, almost criminal activities. But the general idea that, you know, dogs can be learn good and bad things through rewards is really, really important. At the moment, our dog Oz, he's a lovely lad, but he's on the lead a bit more. He's a sight hound, so he tries to chase squirrels, basically. And for his safety, he's on the lead a bit more, but he's developed in the last couple of months. He'll bark at, you know, any dog that comes towards him on a lead. He's now one of those dogs that will really bark at the other dog coming closer. And we're having to really work him with biscuits at the moment. That anytime a dog's come in, I'm scanning the horizon for dogs come in. And when they are, his brain is very much thinking about heel, and it's very much thinking about the reward that he, you know, he's about to get, as long as he can just keep it together and not bark at the other dogs. So it's a challenge, but in some ways, this is one of dogs' greatest strengths, right? They hang around with us, have done for 10,000 years, because they know that the rewards are really good, and they know that we can tick loads of warm social buttons for them. You know, in other words, that we can kind of help one another, I guess.
I hadn't heard of John Paul Scott and John Langworthy Fuller before I picked up your book, but now I'm glad I have heard about them. They taught us a lot about nature and nurture in dogs, and the fact that even what seems like a bad dog is often not beyond redemption.
Yeah, and I mean, we talk a lot about nature and nurture now, don't we? But I think, you know, for between 1940 and 1960, you know, Pavlovian ideas, it was about nurture, it was about kind of what happened to you before, conditioning, etc. And the idea that genes can also influence behavior was completely understudied. So these two scientists, I would say they're the most they're the least well known, but I would say one of the most influential dog scientists or geneticists in the world. And in fact, every famous, it's said that every famous geneticist between the period 1970 to 2000 went through their research facility. So these were really influential, but a lovely pair of guys who were quite quiet, really. So anyway, what were they doing? They were the first people that did long-term studies of dogs. So in other words, they would raise up puppies and treat those puppies to different environments and see the effect that it had on the adult dog those puppies became. And what we got from that, I mean, there's about four or five massive results from that study. One of them was that damaged puppies turn into potentially aggressive and angry adult dogs. You know, those scientists had lived through two world wars, and they were really keen on understanding, you know, why it is that, you know, many parts of society we see, you know, criminal behavior. We see, you know, essentially what they're really thinking is, you know, do people go to prison because they're bad, or were they made bad? And so, you know, those social ideas, they got a chance with dogs to, you know, to try and flesh them out a bit, to try and work out, you know, how much of these things is genetic and how much is, yeah, down to experience. And what that led to with puppies is this idea of the sensitive, in the UK, we call it kind of sensitive period. So, you know, it's between, well, it's up to about 12 weeks in a dog's life. The first 12 weeks are really instrumental. So, you know, the more you can get your dog out there meeting other dogs, the less scared it will be, the more you can get it used to hearing the sounds of cars backfiring or, you know, going past police horses or, you know, unusual sounds or strangers, the more you can get that done in that period, the more confident the dog becomes. So that was one of the things they found. They also, you know, uncovered a few differences in breeds. You know, certain dogs are clearly quite biddable. Certain breeds are, you know, certainly quite biddable. You know, border collies, for instance, you know, absolutely fantastic. Other breeds, sight hounds, for instance, my own dog, not necessarily the, you know, the most biddable dog in the world, I would say. But similarly, you know, differences in smells, you know, obviously bloodhounds, incredible sense of smell. And then Scottish terriers, you know, in their research, they were trying to get a terrier to sniff out a mouse, and the mouse crawled over the terrier's foot once, and the terrier didn't even know. So massive, like, you know, step forward in our understanding of breed differences. But the truth is, from that study, is, you know what, dogs are genetically preconditioned in some ways. They're genetically better at some things according to breed, but probably the best predictor of their outcome in life, if you like, how happy they're predisposed to be, is, you know, is that sensitive period. And in fact, their research is absolutely fascinating, because once they've done that, it's like a 10-year study. You know, suddenly people were like, oh, we probably shouldn't be using dogs in research because it actually damages them. So that is, we started this conversation with your really nice question about, you know, why dogs went into this kind of wilderness period in terms of research. And that essentially, particularly in the US, that was why, you know, it's because, you know, they shouldn't be in science because they can be damaged. And so that's why we focus so much time on chimpanzees and gorillas and dolphins, is because, you know, these animals were too, in some ways you could argue, they were too too easily damaged.
What makes dogs play such a remarkable thing?
I think one of the most, I've been writing about animal behavior for quite a long time. And that when it comes to animal play, I just think it's the most beautiful kind of, it seems to be a mammal thing. And it tends to expose itself when animals are like super relaxed. So, you know, if you see animals playing in a zoo, that's often quite a good sign, because obviously they're in quite a relaxed state. So we talked about mirror tests. One of the other big mysteries in animal cognition is, you know, do animals have theory of mind? So in other words, I'm talking to you, you're talking to me, we understand that we have different brains who see things slightly differently, and together we can have this conversation and kind of meet in the middle. And for a long time, that was thought uniquely human. And lots of interesting stuff with wild chimpanzees and situations where it seems that chimpanzees can recognize that they are an individual brain in a sea of other brains that see things differently to them. And it's all quite elusive. As I say, it's a difficult science to prove, with lots of, you know, rigorous evidence, because these moments when it seems like chimpanzees, I'm sure they can, by the way, I'm sure they do have theory of mind, but we, you know, seeing those moments and recording them in detail can be quite difficult. So I just love the fact that it's dogs that have kind of really underlined that animals can do this, and it's dog play of all things, this beautiful expression of mammalness that we see in our parks. I just love the fact that play seems to be suggesting that, you know, like humans, dogs understand the minds of others, and they try and manipulate them often. So when our dog, the science of this involves videoing dogs playing and watching them in super slow motion. This is Alexandra Horovitz, one of the most awesome American dog cognition experts, watching dogs in slow motion and noting down the techniques that they use to make sure that the play lasts as long as possible. Now, my dog Oz, he lives for play, and not every dog wants to run around like crazy for, you know, half an hour. So it's in his interest to make sure that the other dog keeps playing, keeps enjoying the game. So you can see a dog like Oz, and again, your listeners will know this kind of dogs, you know, basically hi, I want to play. It's like up in the other dog's face. It's like, hi, hi, keeping in the other dog's vision. If the other dog notices a squirrel or a bird, then Oz will move across and again, you know, try and make sure he's maintaining the interest of the dog he wants to play with. He will quite happily change style. So if a dog doesn't like to be chased, he will be the one that runs off and hopes that he's chased. If a dog does like to be chased, he'll gladly do that too. Any kind of yelping or anything like that, Oz will completely straight away change the strength of play and make sure it's not quite as you know, rough and tumble. It is absolutely fascinating that these complex behaviors are playing out in our parks every single day. And again, they sort of get across, I suppose, the emotional complexity of non-human animals. And I just love the fact it's such a positive, wonderful thing that they're showing us through, you know, the thing that is the most exciting and beautiful part of their repertoire, I guess.
Jules, what is the Family Dog Project?
So I mentioned about how the whole nature-nurture debate in the 1960s and early 70s, you know, it was clear that dogs were influenced by, you know, both genes and also prior experience. And as I said, dogs kind of went into the wilderness. Scientifically, they went into the wilderness after that. Except I mentioned about wonder dogs just now. You know, this is another really beautiful story of a wonder dog. So the Family Dog Project changed everything. It changed everything when it comes to dog cognition research. And it started in Hungary. And it started by an absolutely brilliant scientist named Professor Sanyi. And Sanyi didn't start off wanting to learn about dogs. He was really interested in fish. So his whole research institution was just full of fish, and they were learning about how fish mate. So they were looking at fish mating behavior, and that was, you know, that was his life. That was Professor Sanya's life. And he went for a walk one day. He went for a walk in the wilderness up to a large mountain range in Hungary, and stumbled across a dog whose name was Flip. And Flip was kind of just living wild, and Flip followed Sanyi on his walk. And by the end of this massive, massive hike, obviously Professor Sanyi was really worried that the dog would never find its way back again. So he was kind of like, look, you might as well come with me. So Flip joined Sanya's family, and living alongside Flip, it was really obvious to Sanyi that, oh my gosh, like, dogs would do all sorts of crazy things. He started keeping notes. He kept a diary of the unusual things that Flip did. And eventually the diary was so thick with interesting tidbits of behavioral sort of stuff that Sanyi convinced the rest of the laboratory to kind of move the fish on and to study dogs instead, and to study dogs that live with human companions. So the reason this matters is this was the first time really that pet owners, humans with their pet companions, were asked or recruited into science. So the Family Dog Project basically said, look, if you like science and you love your dog, come over, meet me, take part in our projects, and we can hopefully uncover some really, really cool science. And that science is what led me, I suppose, to writing this book, because this science that's come out of that kind of research, where loving family dogs take part in, you know, absolutely amazing science in really warm, compassionate conditions, that's where, like, the really juicy stuff has come from, I suppose.
In 30 seconds, you said loving family dogs. Are scientists willing to say whether our dogs actually love us?
I was always really scared of saying it. I was kind of like, no, this is mammal attachment. Now, having researched this area and talked to hundreds of research scientists, I think there's so much evidence from so many different sources that we'd be crazy not to call it what it is, which is love.
Jules Howard is a wildlife expert, zoology correspondent, science writer, and broadcaster. His new book is called Wonder Dog: The Science of Dogs and Their Unique Friendship with Humans. Jules, this has been delightful. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Oh, thanks ever so much, Chris. It's really nice to speak to you.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can subscribe to our podcast free where you get podcasts, or you can listen at our website, think.kera.org. While you're there, check out upcoming shows we're planning and sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.